Order tonight. We're going to do a little data quiz at the very beginning for 5 minutes, and then I'll introduce the speaker. And in fact, this data quiz is more about one of the past three lectures than it is about tonight, at least as far as I can see. But I won't tell you which lecture. But basically, you see on the screen some data from the United States from 2011. You can ask me questions about it. If you see it right away and you think you're absolutely sure, maybe whisper it or put up your hand. We don't want to spoil the fun for the others. But we're trying to figure out what is going on here. So you have the basic pattern of the data. Can people read enough? Maybe I'll explain one here. The scale, 0, 250, 500, 750, 1,000. On the top graph, it does not start at 0. On the top graph, it starts about 200 and stays at about 200 the whole way across. And the next one, it starts a little under that and goes up high and so on and so on. And the lower one, again, it starts around 250 and whatever. So first question, just for orientation, is what are we talking about here? How many panels do we have, and what do you think the scale is going in this, the axis is going in this direction? Something like, looks like 24 hours going across from midnight to midnight. And then what else do you notice? Your epidemiologists are good at counting. How many panels do we have? 7 panels. So it's 24/7. 24/7 what? And this is some activity. And this is the entire United States. And the numbers on the right-hand side, the 5 numbers, are actual numbers of instances of this, or events. These are events. And if you add them all up, you should get how many happened in the United States in 2011. And there's about 20% missing, because when they collected the data, somebody forgot to write down either the exact minute that it happened or the day or something. Something missing. There's about 20% missing data, because I think if you add up all of them and include the missing dates, I think it comes to four or so million. I don't think those 7 numbers add up to 4 million. So the question is, what on earth is it? So heart attacks is the first vote. So what are people noticing here? Alarms? Before 9 a.m.? Blood pressure? No, it's not a recording of that sort. In fact, the difference here is that these are counts, and they're recorded every minute. But in fact, in the top one, what day are we talking about in the top one? Sunday. There's 52 Sundays in 2011. So the 200 and something events is about 5 events per minute for each week. It's 5 events in that 1 minute for a week, and then there's 50 weeks, so they're added up together across the 50 weeks. Okay? So it's combined over all 50 weeks. But the time is correct. The time of which time on Sunday is correct. And it's not heart attacks, although yes, I understand that heart attacks have a little bit of a peak before going to work on Mondays. The stress of facing that Champlain Bridge. Right? But it's not that. And I don't know if there are 4 million heart attacks a year in the United States or not. We'll see in a minute. We'll see in a minute. Car accidents? Airport activity. But remember that...
Looks like Dorval.
Strokes. Whoever said that, keep quiet. I hope the rest didn't hear you, but you're right. Good. That was very fast. Yeah. It's not blood pressure. It's not about any individual. It's about the entire United States. We're adding up on counting all the events that happen minute by minute for the whole 24 hours, and actually over 50 weeks as well. So it's about five, if you think at the beginning, this is about five events per minute, per week. And this is, it's just, people, a lot of people ask me, this is getting on the internet when you get up, or tweeting, or something like that. But it's not, because if that's the case, people are tweeting all through Sunday morning, all the way through, all the way, tweeting solid all of Sunday. They're tweeting again Monday, if that's what it is, so it isn't that. Any other possibilities? Coffee drinking. People are not drinking coffee at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, the whole way through Sunday. So this activity never stops. It's 24/7. And if we had this graph 100 years ago, Jean-Francois, what do you think? Jean-Francois, 100 years ago, would this be much flatter? Yes. I think there wouldn't be the 8 o'clock. It wouldn't be as peaked as that. There wouldn't be such a peak if it were even 50 years ago. If we went back 50 years ago, there would be much less of a peak at those times. Electricity consumption. No, we're counting events. This involves, it's actually people. This is something that happened to 4 million people. They got out of bed, but they're getting out of bed at 5 per minute per every day of the week. And then they're doing more of it on, no. What are they doing at 12:30? What else do you want to ask me? They're breathing. No. Well, why are they breathing more? See. Okay. If I tell you the event, a lot of people are concentrating on bad events, like heart disease. Somebody said, is it deaths? No, it's a happy event. Births. Why is it like that? You tell us. You, somebody who there up there had the answer. All the C-sections that are planned are done for 8 o'clock in the morning. And some of you who've had C-sections were delayed until there was somebody ahead of you, and then there's another peak again after lunch. Yeah. And the doctors don't work weekends. Okay, so that's the end of that. So tonight's speaker, I'm not going to say much on. You have his bio. But I have to say, and it's putting him on the spot a little bit, that tonight's speaker is the first of the speakers I went to and said, will you do this? Because he was my number one pick, draft pick in this team. And that's all I'm going to say. And away you go, Jean-Francois. You're the first draft pick, and you're on.
So good evening. Thank you for putting that much pressure on my shoulders. Okay, so tonight I'm going to try to give you an overview of the recent decades in epidemiology and the interface between epidemiology and public health. We're basically, in our department, a large group of epidemiologists, and we try to contribute to the advancement of public health. And I'm going to try to illustrate this with various examples. Usually when you go to a movie theater or a play, you're asked to turn off your phone or whatever. Keep them on. If you want to use your smartphone while I speak to look up terms, that may be, you may want to contrast what I'm talking about with what the web says. You'll see that actually I'm going to try to make distinctions between commonly accepted wisdom in Wikipedia, for example, and my views of some items. For example, one of the words I'm going to use a lot tonight is the word epidemic. If you want to look up on your smartphone as I'm speaking, look up the word. What I'm going to say tonight is that whatever you find in Wikipedia or whatever is not what I'm going to talk about. Good. When we give a talk, we're supposed to first say what we're going to say, then say it, and then say what we've said. Those are rules. So I'm And I was asked tonight to make sure that I did that. So that's the way I'm going to first say what I'm going to say. Tonight you're going to see some pictures. For example, a picture of Richard Nixon, a picture about smoking. We're going to talk about AIDS. We're going to talk about the Nazis and cancer. We're going to talk about the first landing on the moon. We're going to talk about the Centers for Disease Control in the USA. We're going to see a small cute baby. And we're going to talk about Ebola, not necessarily in that order. And there will be other pictures, but that's basically filling my screen for now. Okay, so I have here a page from the Globe and Mail from August 23rd. So we're making a bit of noise, huh? If you prefer, I can use this. That's fine. Okay, good. This is an Ebola from the Globe and Mail. And you see the title. It says, "To Stop an Epidemic." So here you have that word, epidemic. It's a word you know, a word you use. It's a word that you find in the lay press. And my question to you is, when you see that word, casually, you just encountered a word, what do you think about? And I'm not going to interact with you now. We're going to keep interactions for the question period later. But I'm pausing for a second now, and I'm asking you, okay, just if you free associate you see that word epidemic, what kinds of thoughts cross your mind? And I'm not going to get answers from you. We're going to come back to this at the question period. But just free associate in your mind. Okay. So, and perhaps some of you have Googled the word while I'm talking. Many of you, I'm sure, thought about situations like the Ebola epidemic. So we have here a very striking picture of a young girl in the midst of the Ebola crisis. That's another interesting picture also, moving picture, about the Ebola epidemic. So I don't know, you know, what crossed your mind, but that would be a fairly typical reaction for many of you when we use the word epidemic to think about that kind of situation. And it's a correct way of thinking about epidemics. Now, if we go back to this Globe and Mail editorial, it's interesting what they said in the text. So that comes from that Globe and Mail editorial. And the word epidemic is found 6-8 times here. They talk about an epidemic of missing and murdered women. This was actually an editorial about Native women in Canada. This was, I think, largely about Winnipeg. But the major problem we have in Canada with Native women disappearing, being murdered. And so they use the word epidemic here to refer to that problem, missing murdered women. Epidemic of criminality. Epidemic of violence. Epidemic of victimization. Lack of education is epidemic, according to the Globe and Mail. Epidemic of joblessness. Epidemic of substance abuse. Epidemic of hopelessness. So I'm sure that for many of you, that's an unusual, unexpected way of referring to the word epidemic, epidemic of victimization. Again, if you've Googled epidemic in Wikipedia, that's not the kind of definition you'll find. For epidemiologists, and I'm going to illustrate that over and over tonight, the concept of epidemic does apply to infectious disease outbreaks like Ebola, but we have a much larger view of the concept of epidemic. So I do agree with the Globe and Mail editors here when they use the term in this way. You could say that sometimes it's just a bit of a metaphor of language, but also technically, for example, I work myself in the field of substance abuse. So when we refer to an epidemic of substance abuse, I'm totally, technically, it's just not a metaphor of the English language. It is a technical, an appropriate technical use of the term epidemic. Now that I've made that point, I'm going to broaden examples events that I would consider epidemics. For example, the influenza epidemic of 1918-1999. That, I think, we have no problem calling that an epidemic. You know, it's infectious. It appeared suddenly. It was an outbreak that was devastating. Again, I'm going to ask you a question, but I will not get the answer. I will not interact with you, but in your mind, if you had to guess how many deaths were caused by that epidemic, just guess in your mind, and I'm not going to get answer from you. But what would be your wild guess? So I'm counting to three, showing you the answer. Okay, so over 40 million deaths were associated with that epidemic. World War II, and you know, today is Remembrance Day, so I think it's appropriate to discuss mortality or other types of casualties associated with war. Now, wars are man-made disasters that lead to a lot of disease, of death, and for an epidemiologist, man-made problems causing disease and death are basically seen as epidemiologic problems. So World War II led to 52 million deaths. So this was, in my view as an epidemiologist, there was a major epidemic of mortality among young men, other age groups, women as well. But if you focus on one of those groups, young men were dying by the million during those 5 years. And if you look at that statistically, it was an epidemic. I mean, people were dying much too much. There were too many of them dying. We like to include in our analyses, in our thinking, man-made disasters due to political circumstances or others. Coming back now to something more classical, the AIDS epidemic, if I focus on the 20th century, was associated then, we'll come back to AIDS to see that it's become a much larger problem, in the 20th century it was associated with 16 million deaths. Okay, so I highlight again World War II, because I'm sure for most of you it did not fit in your view of what we call an epidemic. And if you don't like it, you don't have to take it home. But it's just to try to make the point that what is our focus in epidemiology is the excess of bad outcomes, the excess of deaths, the excess of disease, whatever the context, is of interest to us. So for me, those examples do fit the definition of the word epidemic. I want to continue to illustrate that with another example here. My field of research is largely addiction. So here we have overdose deaths in women in the United States in the last 10 years or so. We may often think that what drug addicts die from on the street is due to street drugs like heroin. Now, heroin is bad, and heroin does cause overdoses. And actually, last summer in Montreal, there was an epidemic of overdose deaths on the street and associated with opiates. Some of it being heroin. What's interesting is that we're now in a situation that's totally different from 20 years ago, where what's killing people now from opiate overdoses is not as much heroin as prescribed pills. Prescription opiates have become now a major public health problem. And again, in my jargon, I would say that in the recent years, in the last decade or so, we've been faced with a huge epidemic of opiate overdose deaths. Okay. Having made that point, of my definition of that term, I'm going to walk you through some examples. One of them is this story here, which is a story of an epidemic that was described in the top medical journal Lancet in 1971, and that was the time when I was myself a student, where I was grappling with that term, epidemic, what it means, and I was... That was a kind of paper that surprised me then when I was reading medical literature. So what's interesting for me in the story I'm going to tell you is that there had been that epidemic that I'm going to describe that had been unrecognized. They just stumbled on it while doing a piece of research. So that's the title of their paper. It's, and I'm going to go through the jargon, so that their paper was titled Unrecognized Epidemic of Anencephaly and Spina Bifida. Don't worry about the jargon, I'm coming back to it. So let's look at those terms. Basically, these two terms refer to birth defects, so I said that study was conducted at Harvard. This is the baby I promised I would show. So the just to basically indicate, the red line here shows the spinal column. How do you say that? That's the term. Yeah? Okay, and using that picture here, spina bifida is a birth defect affecting the lower part of the spine, while anencephaly affects the head. So those are severe birth defects that were studied by these Harvard epidemiologists. And again, what struck me in that story was that it had been unrecognized. Here we have statistics over almost a century showing in Massachusetts the rates of those birth defects over time. And you can see that the usual rate for those birth defects was about 2%. So that's basically what was known about that disease. But for a period of time, roughly a period of 20 years, there was a massive peak, a doubling of the rate, going up to even more than double, to 5%. And this was going on in Massachusetts, so a birth defect that had become much more prevalent, much more frequent, and nobody noticed it. So it was ongoing a fairly important problem, not a trivial health problem, and nobody had noticed it. Two Harvard epidemiologists stumbled on this while doing some other piece of research. They were looking up records about birth defects and compiling statistics, and they were not chasing, trying to uncover this epidemic. They just discovered it by accident after the fact. And that epidemic, by the way, remained unexplained. We don't know what happened in Massachusetts to cause this. So this illustrates one kind of situation that preoccupies epidemiologists. It's a question of, you know, are we, even today as we sit here tonight in Montreal, could it be that there are epidemics around us affecting us that we're not detecting, causing major health issues? That's one of our professional preoccupations, and we're constantly thinking about ways of monitoring the health of the public to make sure that we pick up problems as they arise, not after the fact. Okay. Now I'm going to come to say a chapter that I called Modern Epidemiology. I've divided the next sections into three broad chapters, and I've decided arbitrarily begin the period of modern epidemiology around 1950. You will see in a few minutes that major epidemiological studies that changed the way we think about health, the way we do research, were initiated around that time. But there's always arbitrariness in choosing a date. So I said 1950, but I have to go back to an earlier time to lead into the studies from the 1950s. In 1939, there was a piece of research that was published in Germany. And in that case, it was not like the previous example. Researcher was interested in an epidemic that was already well recognized by everybody at that time. So we have here a different kind of context where we know we have a problem, but we cannot explain, you know, we don't know what is the cause of that problem. So what was that problem? It was basically what I would call a cancer epidemic. So here we have a figure with various causes of cancer. This is one of the most striking facts of 20th century epidemiology. 100 years ago, lung cancer was an extremely rare disease, the kind of disease that if you were a doctor and you saw one case, you would call all of the medical students to show that case, that patient, to those students, because that might be the only case you would see in your career. It was, you know, in the early 1900s, lung cancer was a rarity. But then it became, over the 20th century, a major health issue. Already in the 30s, even though the epidemic curve was still quite low, clinicians had noticed that there was a new disease on the block. There was lung cancer, something that the previous generation of doctors did not see or saw only rarely. So here we had a situation where we had a disease that was increasing in frequency, and people had no clue what was the cause of that disease of lung cancer. The arrow here points to this curve, which again, in my jargon, clearly we have a disease of epidemic proportion. It's clearly in excess of anything we would expect from looking at the past. I'm sure some of you in the room read German. I'm going to translate. In my mind, this was for a long time actually a very obscure paper published in German in 1939 when people had other kind of concerns than reading medical papers, especially in German. But with hindsight, for me, it's one of the most interesting piece of research of the 20th century. For me, it's a landmark paper. I found out about it in that book here. It's called The Nazi War on Cancer. If you have historical inclinations, I recommend that book. The author, Proctor, is often a consultant in trials against cigarette companies. And I think he was in Montreal some time ago for one of those legal battles. So Proctor describes the bigger story than what I'm going to describe tonight, but describes this research that was conducted initially in Germany around cigarettes, around lung cancer. Here in that paper, we have the key hypotheses, and I'm going to translate, that were considered at that time to explain what could be the cause of the epidemic of lung cancer. Again, people had no idea what was the cause of that epidemic. And certainly cigarettes were considered to be harmless, and people could not imagine that cigarettes could be a cause. And the kinds of hypotheses that were circulating at that time were things like street dust. There were more and more automobiles on the street, so exhaust from automobiles, the tar on the street. That actually is a cause of cancer. So the mustard gas that was used in World War I has been shown to cause lung cancer. So that was one of the hypotheses. X-rays, influenza, trauma in general, tuberculosis, industrialization. So those were the kinds of hypotheses that were circulating at that time. What's interesting is that the author says, whatever it is, there is something out there causing lung cancer, and we're going to find it. Now, in 2014, that statement here may seem benign, but that historically, there was often that view about chronic diseases that they were just a matter of, you know, we're getting older, so the body degenerates, and we get sick. And there's no real explanation other than aging. This was often the way we saw cancer. It was the way we saw cardiovascular disease. This was the way we saw dementia, Alzheimer's, not too long ago. Epidemiologists have a different view of this, and epidemiologists make the hypothesis that if you have a health problem, there must be something out there that's responsible for it. So this investigator decided to look at smoking, and again, that's a table in German, but if I summarize a key point, he compared the rate of smoking, of heavy smoking, in cases of cancer. So in cancer cases here, there were 30% of them, 29%, who were heavy smokers, while in a group of healthy people, it was only 4 or 5%. So here he found an association between having cancer and a heavy smoking. So this was here the first significant piece of research associating smoking with cancer. Then that study was basically forgotten for a decade or two. In epidemiology, since we often cannot experiment, we just grab human beings and we ask them questions, you know, do you smoke, do you not smoke, and so on. There are a lot of possible biases that arise in our research. For example, here, a questionnaire about smoking could be poorly designed and not really get the correct answers. The selection of subjects might have been inappropriate. It could be that there are other variables here that should be taken into account. So the job of an epidemiologist is to make sure that your study is designed correctly. And it's not just one piece of research like this that will convince the world that there's a problem. So more research was needed. So we now jump back to the 50s, to after the war, in the UK. And this is another landmark paper from 20th century epidemiology, published in 1954. The author, Richard Dahl, I'm going to say a bit more about him in a few minutes, was then a young investigator who wanted to look at that question. What he decided to do is to study doctors. He tried to recruit all of the doctors in the UK at that time, sent questionnaires about their smoking habits, and then decided to follow them for decades to see what they would die from. The fact that the human subjects here were doctors is just like an accident. The interest here was about smoking. It's convenient to study doctors in that kind of context because doctors are registered in the country where they work. They have a license, so they're a fairly stable population and they're somewhat easy to trace. They will tend to, if they respond to a questionnaire, you may hope that they will be reliable. They're not good respondents, but when they do, you may hope that the data will be of interest. So in any case, Richard Dahl undertook that study with doctors. 50 years later, the British Medical Journal published an anniversary paper where they presented the results. I mean, obviously, Dr. Dahl published results after results of that study over those 50 years. But at 50 years later, there was this anniversary paper that was published where results of a whole career of research were presented. And you will notice in the title that it refers to male British doctors, but there was research also on women by the same investigators. And the results, I mean, we know cigarettes also cause lung cancer in women, but the strength of the association is a bit different. So here we have a picture of Richard Dahl at the end of his career. Richard Dahl is one of our heroes. We all agree in our community of epidemiologists that he should have received a Nobel Prize for his research. As you may know, if you're going to win a Nobel Prize, it's because somebody nominated you. So there's a nomination process, there's a lobbying that's required. And epidemiologists have not been sufficiently well organized to do that. I think there's a consensus in the scientific community that he's a monument of research even outside epidemiology for his contribution to various questions, smoking being one of his key ones. Going back to that picture here, I should mention as an aside that the second author, Bradford Hill, is also somebody who was famous in our field. He was basically a mentor to Richard Dahl. He had a statistical training, he worked a lot on defining criteria that epidemiologists should meet to decide whether a piece of research is valid or not. So we have that term here in our field, Bradford Hill criteria. I don't have a picture of Richard Dahl when he began his career. I know he looked very young, probably not that young. He's not the only one who did that. You know, start, you know, when you're 25, 30 with a piece of research and throughout your life continue the follow-up. You have to be very patient to do that. By then, with this kind of research and other, people began to accept the notion that tobacco causes lung cancer. When I was a student in a place like here, people would smoke in the auditorium, and that was just the way things were done, because it took a long time to accept that smoking was a hazard. So it's not because there was a good study in 1939 or a good study in 1954 that people were swayed. It took a long evolution. So we have that paper in 1939, that paper in 1954. In 1964, the U.S. Surgeon General issued a report that is famous because the Surgeon General stated, using, among other things, those Bradford Hill criteria that I discussed earlier, stated that, yes, now we can say scientifically, validly, that cigarettes cause cancer and other diseases. And you see that the smoking prevalence curve begins to plateau, there was a turnaround at that time. It's always a debate in epidemiology. Do we agree or not agree that something causes a disease? It's a long process that requires a lot of research, but it's also a social consensus. And when somebody like the U.S. Surgeon General says it's a problem, it's like a stamp of approval on a large body of scientific research, and it begins to sway people in a different direction. Okay, so if I come back to this table here, I will add the cigarettes, and again, I'm going to count to three and give you time to guess. What do you think is the number of deaths that cigarettes caused during the 20th century? So try to come up with a number. So, and let's see how well you guessed. So cigarettes have caused 100 million deaths over the 20th century, and the 21st century will not be better. Cigarettes are marketed all over the planet very aggressively, and continue to be a major problem. Okay, I've spoken about unrecognized epidemics, the birth defect story. I've spoken about a well-recognized epidemic, lung cancer, well-recognized but unexplained until decades of research showed that lung cancer, cigarettes were the problem. Just as an aside here, just a peripheral example, sometimes we notice that something is going away without our understanding what's going on. And coming back to this curve here, we saw lung cancer. Look at the stomach cancer curve. Stomach cancer for epidemiologists is very interesting because if you go back to the early 20th century, stomach cancer was it. You know, it was top cause or top. It was the number one killer in terms of cancer. And that cancer gradually declined over time and continues to decline. We don't know why. We don't have a clue. We never put together prevention programs. We never put together screening programs. So, we can formulate a lot of hypotheses when you say we don't have a clue. I mean, we can formulate hypotheses, including perhaps better treatment. But it's interesting also for epidemiologists to come across those kinds of statistics where some disease is going away and we did nothing for this to happen. It just seems to happen. It's interesting. We often worry about, for example, chemicals in our food, about fertilizers on crops and getting into the food chain. So we worry about chemicals when we go buy our food and whether it causes cancer. Well, perhaps chemicals cause cancer. Perhaps fertilizers do. But certainly, when we look at the curve like this, it does not seem to bother our stomachs. So just as an aside here, another kind of problem that epidemiologists are interested in. This kind of observation may be very fruitful. The fact that something is going away may suggest interesting hypotheses about the causes of cancer. So that's just an aside here. Okay, so I said I would divide the time period I'm covering into different chapters. I've decided to call the 70s the golden years. This is an arbitrary choice that I made, even though preparing this here, I've come across other authors who actually think of the 70s in this way as well. Coming back to this here, we have here one of the reasons we can think of the 70s as golden years. There was here this battle with lung cancer that epidemiologists felt had won. You know, epidemiology with Richard Dahl and others had shown that if you put together a well-designed study and you're patient, you take the 20 years that you need to do the piece of research with good methods, that you can identify the cause of a problem, and then you can convey that to the general public. You can change the lifestyle of people. People will begin to stop smoking. So there was a feeling here that epidemiologists have ways of finding out about causes of disease and influencing for the best the health of the public. So that's an example here of the euphoria about that perhaps epidemiologists lived in the 70s. There are other examples. In the 70s, there was a feeling that we had conquered infectious diseases. Here we have a very dramatic curve showing the decline in mortality from infectious diseases over the 20th century. That decline may be explained by several causes. Vaccines are one of them. And we live in an era where people are very suspicious about vaccines. It's very important to look back historically at the good that vaccines have contributed to the general public health. There's also improved socioeconomic conditions, better sanitation, better medical care. There are several explanations, but the point is that, again, in the 70s, infectious diseases had begun to be perceived as irrelevant. I did my doctoral studies in epidemiology at that time. I spent 4 years studying epidemiology, and I think I studied infectious diseases for about 2 hours in 4 years. Basically, you did not study infectious diseases. We were not prepared for a career in infectious diseases because, you know, the data showed that it was pointless. So there was that feeling again of ability for epidemiology and public health to conquer problems. That's another example happened in the 70s. The last case of smallpox on the planet occurred in 1977. Now that's a little bit of a lie because there has been since then, the smallpox virus is still kept in a few labs over the planet. So the virus caused a few infections around those labs, you know, in workers. But what we can call natural cases of the disease, that was the last case. So here, mankind had shown that we could, you know, we could eradicate diseases like smallpox. So now that it had been done with smallpox, the view was, well, let's go to the next one. For example, currently poliomyelitis is a target for eradication. So we continue with that same paradigm, but it's very difficult. Continuing in this view about the golden 70s, 1971, Nixon signed a bill declaring the war on cancer. And the context is very interesting. That's at a time when Americans had been very successful achieving major projects, major adventures. The moon landing had been a tremendous success story for Americans, basically seeing the Russians in the late 50s beating them to space. They sat down and put together a plan to go from A to B to C to the moon over a decade, and it worked. They followed the plan and succeeded. So there was this view that if you sit down and write a good plan, that you can conquer whatever problem is facing you. And that was the approach, basically, or the context in which the war on cancer was declared. And again, there was this optimism that, you know, if we write a plan and we do it well, we invest, it will work. We now know that, and I think that the idea was, you know, let's give it 25 years and cancer will have been conquered. We now know that it's not the way it works for cancer. But in these days, that was, you could just write a law to outlaw cancer, basically. Okay. But the 70s came to an end. And again, this is my term. I decided that I would call that postmodern epidemiology, because many of the assumptions that we had made during the earlier times were challenged. And I'm going to use AIDS to describe this. So here, a great book by Jacques Pépin. Jacques Pépin is a professor at Sherbrooke University, and he wrote here a book that got tremendous coverage in the scientific press. The magazine Science reviewed it and gave it rave reviews. It's a great book, very well written. And, you know, if you're looking for something interesting to read, I'd suggest this. Pépin continues to work in that field. He had a paper in the journal Science 2-3 weeks ago, continuing his research on the question of AIDS. So I'm going to use a time scale here to tell a little bit of that story. So the story begins in 1981. And here, with that story, we're going to illustrate another way that epidemiological research may begin. We've seen, you know, various examples now. With the birth defect story, it was epidemiologists looking up medical records and, you know, collecting data on statistics on birth defects. With lung cancer, you know, there was this hypothesis about cigarettes, and then you studied people who smoked and did not smoke. Here, it was an accidental observation. There was a technician at the Centers for Disease Control who just, by chance, observed something. So, Centers for Disease Control, CDC, they're very important in our domain, in public health. It's a huge enterprise responsible for public health monitoring in the United States, but they also are the people who chase the Ebola virus and so on. So they have also an international perspective. They produce every week a report that I'm always eager to read. There's always interesting stuff in it. And some landmark events in epidemiology began with CDC reports. So what was that observation? So there is a drug that's called pentamidine that is not routinely available in the United States. But if you, as a doctor, you feel that you need it, and it's used for rare, for various purposes, but including rare, unusual infections of the lung, If you need it, you have to write to CDC, make a request. That technician observed that suddenly there was a peak in requests. Actually, he saw 5 requests for that drug from different parts of the country. But those 5 requests were all in his desk pretty much at the same time. And it was unusual. So he wondered whether there was something going on. This observation was reported in the weekly report from the CDC. That's called the MMWR for Mortality and Mortality Weekly Report. In June 81, and it was not published it did not make any kind of headline. It was a benign, casual observation that they felt we should report about it, but no big deal. They were not sure that it was of any real significance. I find that date interesting, 1981, June 1981, because that's when I got my doctoral degree to begin my career. And as I told you, that's exactly the very month I got my own doctoral degree. And as I told you, I had absolutely no training in infectious disease epidemiology. And the very month I get my degree, the world changes. Now, a new epidemic that would change the face of the world, that would change the practice of people like myself, that would change the practice of public health, was beginning, and I was totally unprepared. My degree was already stale, and I had not begun to work. That's an interesting lesson about continuing education. And I was actually very insecure in these early years. I was called as a young new professor to sit on committees where we discussed hepatitis C, AIDS, and so on, with absolutely no preparation to do that. Obviously, I picked up, but it was an interesting clash. So that was their report. They decided to look up those 5 cases, and they were 5 young men. It was noticed that they were homosexual, and they had this rare infection, no clue what caused it. So various anecdotes anecdotal information was recorded. For example, it was noticed that they were using some drugs to enhance sexual pleasure when they had sex. They were called poppers. And one of the early hypotheses was not that it was a virus or it was an infection. It was that it was drug-induced by poppers. At that time, the idea that it was infectious was not yet considered. But then, very rapidly, research got moving. It took only 2 years for the virus to be discovered. It's here very interesting to see how much mankind has progressed in terms of facing new challenges like this. Only 2 years. When you think about the plague in the Middle Ages or Renaissance, we're in a different world. We have identified over 60 million cases over the world. Okay, one question that this book addresses is, okay, we have those 5 cases in 1981, but where did they come from? What happened for those 5 cases to occur? And I'm not going to give you the whole story. Some of you, I'm sure, know part of it, but I'm going to give you some of the facts that I found interesting. Pepin, in his research, basically demonstrates that in the early 20s, between the early 20s and 1981, the epidemic was in progress. So it's fascinating that for about 60 years, the HIV epidemic was out there, progressing, infecting more and more people, and nobody knew about it. So this epidemic has been with us since around 1920. Now, recent research says earlier, 1900 even. So for decades, this epidemic has been rampant, has been infecting, this virus has been infecting people, and nobody noticed. Going back to this here, what we understand now is that it's a virus that came from chimpanzees, and that through the handling of chimpanzee meat by hunters or their wives, that there was contamination from the blood, and that a first case happened early in the century. And this probably actually happened more than once over decades. So from chimpanzee to human, it happened, we know actually it happened more than once. But there was this initial case almost 100 years ago now. Okay. And then once the virus had established itself in human beings, then the social circumstances in Africa made it possible for the virus to spread. There was urbanization in Africa. That came with a prostitution in the large cities. Often men went to those cities to work without their wives, so there was a concentration of men in cities without their family. So prostitution grew. So that's one set of explanations. One other set of explanations is quite fascinating. It's highly plausible, and again, Pepin defends this hypothesis, that the other culprit was the medical care system, that the hygiene in terms of using needles and medical instruments at that time was not, the standards were not what they are today, and probably going to clinics, getting vaccines, and so on, contributed also to the spread of the infection. Okay. So I'm going to wrap up now with a couple of slides. So that was a very brief overview of the big picture of AIDS. It's much more complicated than this, but that gives you the flavor. HIV brought with it a lot of social changes. For example, the question of sexual identity. We now live in a world where the homosexual identity is much more, we're much more open about this. It's more broadly accepted. Homosexual identity, if you go back prior to the HIV epidemic, was something that was much more much more private and not really accepted the way it is now. One other thing that happened is that the typical patient during the HIV epidemic was early on a young male, educated, the expectation of those new patients were different from the traditional patients. They insisted to have a say in the way research was conducted on their disease. They insisted to have a say on the way clinical trials were conducted. They were not happy with getting placebos when new drugs were tested. And they influenced the way drug research was conducted so that they could benefit from the research very rapidly. It led to fast-tracking the processes of research and changed the way we involve patients in research. And now this has become a common practice. If you go to a different field, the field of diabetes in Canada, the native population is affected with the diabetes at a higher rate than the rest of the population. Well, when we do diabetes research in Canada in that population, we involve them. We involve the native population, First Nation, in the way we design our research and the way we present the research results. This also led to the development of the concept of harm reduction. Harm reduction may be a technical jargon for you. In public health, it's a very important philosophy. Harm reduction means that you accept that people will have dangerous behaviors like injecting drugs, but you will try to create circumstances where it's the safest possible. So rather than abstain from using drugs, we take a perspective that some people will never abstain. So if they're not going to abstain, let's then work on reducing at least the risk that they incur when they use drugs. So, and the same for sexual practices. You can, if you abstain from sex, then it's super safe. If you're going to have sex, say with a prostitute, well, then at least use safe practices. The prostitute should use safe practices and the client. So that's a philosophy that has been promoted in the context of the AIDS epidemic. And finally, probably the whole notion of compassion for victims is also something that has evolved with the AIDS epidemic. I have a picture here of a man 3 days before his death. That was taken in 1986, I believe. And that picture is famous because I understand that at that it got extensive coverage when it was first published. And what it elicited is a lot of compassion, I understand, from reading about this picture. When we talk about AIDS, we don't talk about disease. We talk about living with AIDS. This whole philosophy of a compassionate approach, a positive approach to disease, is something that came also with the AIDS epidemic. By contrast, this is from a cigarette package, where the whole approach to cigarettes is to blame the victim. So we see a contrast here between different philosophies regarding disease. Okay, so I'm going to, I said that there were three steps in a talk. You say what you're going to say, you say it, and then you say what you've said. I think to say what I've said, I'm going to come back to two pictures. That picture here of this young girl, she's 9 years old, and she's taken away because she's probably infected with the Ebola virus. And here, this other one is also 9 years old, and in this case, she's an orphan because her family died from Ebola. I like to show those pictures to bring home the message that epidemiologists, public health people have a mission. It's to make this world a better place. We do research to have an impact on health. When I showed that picture to students recently, they said, well, this is a very bad picture. They felt that this young girl was actually mismanaged, you know, that there was a bit of violence in that picture, the way she was pulled away from wherever she lives. So it's interesting the angles that you can take on pictures. Okay, thank you very much.
Good, thank you. Hello, I'm Rebecca Fuhrer, and I'm the former chair of the department, and very proud to see our faculty teaching you and presenting some of the very issues that we deal with all the time. I would also like to thank Jean-François Boivin for his excellent presentation. You can understand why he's won many awards within the department and within the faculty and has trained many of the epidemiologists across Canada and elsewhere during his career at McGill. So thank you very much. So I'm supposed to wave this at you. You all have them. If you have written questions on them, please raise your arm with the card in it, and our student aides will come and pick them up and bring them down for Dr. Boivin.
So we have a question here. I think this question was triggered by my example about birth defects. Mm-hmm. So mothers who live... Yep. I don't think so, but... Is it possible that I press the button? Okay. Otherwise, I can use this here. I can use... So are we on? Yeah, I think so. Okay. Mothers who lived near Niagara, St. Catharines, who gave birth to babies with birth defects or dead babies due to living near the Love Canal. So for many of you, Love Canal will bring back memories. Hasn't been researched as an epidemic after the fact. So so the Love Canal story on my feet now, I'm just going to improvise from memory. But there was concerns because of heavy industrial pollution in that region that there could be health problems. And from this question here, I presume that there were reproductive issues, but cancer. That question is interesting because obviously when we give a talk like this here, we like to present our good stories where things worked. And Love Canal is an example of a very difficult situation where it was in this region, there was a soup of hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals, and there was no way to pinpoint to a specific cause. It's often the case in epidemiology that we face complex environmental exposures, pollution of various types, and we try to relate them to various diseases, we get nowhere, basically. Here the problem is, on one hand, this complex soup of chemicals is difficult to disentangle. On the other hand, you don't know exactly what to look for in terms of a disease. Birth defects are very difficult to study because each of them is very rare. The example I gave today of spina bifida is one of the most common ones. But when you go to and look at others, like heart defects, brain defects, gastrointestinal defects, so on, each of them is so rare that you end up with no number in your to work with. So that's a good question because it illustrates the difficulties that we often face as epidemiologists with those kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, have epidemiologists looked at the possibility that refrigeration may have been a factor in decline of stomach cancer? Yeah. So, that's a very interesting hypothesis. I don't know. We can certainly correlate ecologically. We call that in our jargon ecological studies. You know, over time, stomach cancer has declined, and over time, we've been using more and more refrigeration. So that seems to be a link that makes sense. But beyond making that hypothesis, it's not really testable. The less use of pickling or smoking foods to preserve them. So there are studies of charred meat, for example, barbecued food and so on, where we can show that if you use certain processes in preparing your food, that you will actually cause the carcinogens to be present in what you eat. So we know that, for example, charcoal can create chemicals in your food that is carcinogenic. We have not made the explicit link in human beings, but that makes a lot of sense because in animal studies, that's what we see.
It's the same.
Yeah. Okay. Is there an epidemic of dementia today? So whoever wrote that is a very good student. You got my definition of epidemic. Okay. So we certainly have the impression we see more than in the past. It's not my field of research, so I will be careful about my answer, but I will use that question to highlight issues that we deal with in epidemiology. It could be that dementia is not more frequent than in the past, but better diagnosed. So if you diagnose a disease more often because you have better tools, better imaging, better screening tests, then statistically you'll see more of a disease, but it's an artifact of having better diagnostic methods. So we always are careful about this when we see an epidemic curve. And even for lung cancer, somebody could have said in 1930, well, it's just that now we are better doctors than in the past. There's no epidemic. So there is that question. The other question is, just if, because the population is aging, you would see, expect to see more cases of dementia. And the question is, should you adjust for that age structure? So it could be that once you've taken into account the fact that the population is older, well, within the older people, it's the same as before, but we have more old people than in the past. So depending on your perspective, there is an epidemic or there is no epidemic. If I'm the Minister of Health and I have to give budgets to hospitals to take care of demented people, for me as a budget manager, there is an epidemic because I have to give more money than in the past. If I am a biologist trying to understand the question of dementia, it could be that once age is adjusted for, it's the same as 50 years ago. From that perspective, as a biologist, there is no epidemic. So the standpoint that you take to ask a question changes your view of whether it is an epidemic or not. Don't we consider the thalidomide an epidemic? So thalidomide was a pill prescribed for pregnancy, for nausea during pregnancy in the 50s, and yes, thalidomide caused a very rare kind of limb defect, a birth defect, and it was called phocomelia. So children were born with malformed arms and legs. This epidemic was picked up very rapidly because that was a birth defect that was unknown. A bit like lung cancer in 1900, you know, nobody knew about lung cancer, it was unknown. That birth defect, phocomelia, was also something that obstetricians never saw. And suddenly, within a few months, in several countries over the world, there was this new unknown birth defect. So it was rapidly obvious that something was going on. So coming back to the left canal story earlier, here we have a clear case, a new disease, well-defined, unknown, and we knew what to study. There was that disease that was well-identified. On the other hand, it was rapidly obvious that there was this new pill that was prescribed to women. Again, contrast this with left canal, where we have hundreds or thousands of chemicals in a soup. Here we have one molecule and one new disease, and the link is much more easily made. And this is where epidemiologists can brag and say, you know, that we're great scientists and we find solutions to problems. So here that was historically one of the epidemics that also changed the way we do things. After that thalidomide epidemic, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, changed the way it oversees the regulation of new drugs. It's historically very important. At McGill and in several university departments, we are interested in drugs like thalidomide and want to make sure that they are not causing epidemics of various sorts. The Celebrex epidemic of a few years ago is another example where this anti-inflammatory was associated with myocardial infarctions. In that case, it took a long time because a lot of people have heart attacks, and a lot of people took Celebrex, and even though there was an epidemic of heart attacks, it took a very long time for epidemiologists to notice it because heart attacks are common. Uh, are unrecognized epidemics more likely to occur in areas with poor medical care and diagnosis? I don't know the answer to that question. What I'm trying to do tonight is to promote the notion that you should give me a job, that, you know, we need epidemiologists. So to in the field of public health, it's called public health surveillance. So the surveillance, the monitoring of the health of populations is something very important. And if you don't monitor, if you don't conduct surveillance, obviously you will miss epidemics. If we accept that drug abuse in Montreal is an epidemic, please comment on the opening today of a cannabis clinic to assist patients to manage their disease and or pain with prescription cannabis. Okay. My other hat is I am an addiction, I'm a family physician working in addiction clinic at the Jewish Hospital in Montreal. So I'm very interested in this question. On Saturday, I spent a whole day in New Hampshire at the Dartmouth Medical Center, a whole day on medical cannabis. So this is something that is really on my mind. I think it's clear that medical cannabis may be useful to patients for certain applications. But I'm totally with the Quebec College of Physicians that says we need rigor. And the College of Physicians says if you're going to use cannabis, it must be scientifically justified. When I prescribe any other drug, it's been researched. The side effects are known. The dosage is known. The contraindications are known. With cannabis, we don't have that. So there are very narrow indications where we begin to have a consensus, you know, chronic pain in cancer patients who are terminal. It seems the president of the College of Physicians of Quebec said today on the radio that probably for diseases like multiple sclerosis, it can help. So there are indications for which there is some medical consensus, but we must approach this with a rigorous scientific protocol, and this is what the College of Physicians in Quebec is asking us to do. So that's my answer to this. And it's important to distinguish when we discuss cannabis, recreational use and medical use. And it's easy to confuse the two problems.
It's very lighthearted.
Is there an epidemic of depression after the clocks go back an hour? I went to a talk today about sleep in teenagers. At noon, there was a talk at the Jewish Hospital, an expert at the Douglas Hospital who works on this. So she found, a very rigorous scientist at the Douglas, she found that when you give teenagers an additional hour to sleep, they conducted experiments with, you know, randomization, very rigorous comparison group, that if you give them an hour more to sleep and then you conduct various tests, they will be less irritable, they will perform better in class, they will succeed better in math, in English, in French. So at least in teenage, and also if you did that kind of research with ADHD teenagers, that they are much more symptomatic if you deprive them of an hour of sleep. And they will do better if you give them an hour extra to sleep in the morning. So it's not really the answer to your question. But I think it's somewhat related. I also know of research that suggests that people who, now we're not in teenagers anymore, people who wake up at a regular early hour would be less depressed than people who just stay in bed for long periods of time in the morning. Whether the research is rigorous or not, I don't know. Okay. So one or two questions, and I think I'll allow you to go back home. So what happened in 1981 to trigger the flare-up in the AIDS epidemic? Why didn't it occur earlier? So read that book. Because it's the interplay between biology and sociology, the hypotheses are that the virus crossed the Atlantic to go to Haiti because there were Haitian soldiers in Africa for some mission. Sexual tourism in Haiti brought the virus in the USA, and then it took off. So some of it has to do with the international travel that is much more intense than in the past. So that's part of the explanation. So should we wrap up here, or do you want more? We'll wrap up. Okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you.